This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection, and I'll introduce my guest shortly, but before I do, I want to continue on a theme we've been exploring for the last several weeks, and that's the idea of logical fallacies. When we have people on the air that are discussing issues that you're listening to, or you're having discussions with someone at home or school, you're trying to make a decision about the validity of this argument or this discussion, and logical fallacies are commonly used to try to get to sway people's opinions, and when you really sit down and think about them, they are false. They're not real. We've used the idea that just because you're an authority doesn't mean everything you say is going to be correct, that two things being closely happening in time don't necessarily mean they're causally related, and things like that that have been very important. And today I want to talk about one called the ad hominem argument. That's usually done when somebody's arguing that the conclusions reached by somebody are not correct because they're attacking the person or one of their beliefs or some false negative quality possessed by the person. For example, I recently overheard a soccer player complaining that her parents shouldn't be telling her how to improve her soccer since neither parent had ever played soccer, particularly not at a very high level. The problem with that is the advice being given may be correct, but it has nothing to do with whether or not the person played soccer or not. So when you're looking at arguments and stuff, you want to look at the logic and the evidence that are being promoted, and it's not always true that just because someone didn't do something, they may not have the correct answer. The advice being given to the soccer player could have been, and in this case, I think was quite appropriate, even though the player did not want to particularly hear it and use the ad hominem argument to kind of discourage that idea. My guest today is Dr. Paul Hochfeld. Dr. Hochfeld left electrical engineering and a BS and a master's degree in electrical engineering from MIT to pursue interest in medicine, and then eventually ended up as an emergency room physician. Not stimulated enough by that. He's been a little bit bent out of shape, it seems like, by our healthcare system, which a lot of us are beginning to be that way. And he's gotten so interested in it that he's developed a website called Our Ailing Healthcare. .com and also produced a short film documentary called Health, Money, and Fear. Dr. Hochfeld, welcome to Line One.
Thank you.
It's great to meet you. I have to say I've looked at the DVD a couple of times now, and we've linked how to get to your website along with a couple weeks ago we interviewed Joe Neal, who's done a series of reports on NPR comparing our healthcare system to some Western European systems, and also to an interview done about a year ago now with Uwe Reinhardt, a health economist at Princeton, kind of different ways of looking at these issues. But let's get right down to the basic. What's the problem with our healthcare system as you see it?
Well, it's at the core, it's not about health; it's about money. And we've got a healthcare system that's built around this sort of capitalism. And I'm happy with capitalism when it comes to golf clubs and gin. But when it comes to healthcare, it just doesn't work so well. Mm-hmm. And if you just step back from it just a little bit, the way we've got all these suppliers in the system, and that's our physicians and hospitals and clinics and drug companies and insurance companies and lawyers. Lawyers are in the system too. And because of the reimbursement schemes in our healthcare system, the way to make the most profits is to invoke technology to keep really sick people from dying or to make sick people get a little better. Mm-hmm. You don't make money in this system that we've got by keeping people healthy or by helping people with chronic disease not stumble and get sick. And so the magic of the marketplace in this capitalistic system we have almost guarantees that we're going to be maximizing profits, which means maximizing disease. And besides that, the usual laws of supply and demand don't work in healthcare like they do elsewhere. And the main reason for that, I believe, is that physicians have too much control over demand. And the way a physician increases the demand is by ordering more tests.
Right.
And patients rarely ask the physician, gosh, I don't know, that sounds kind of expensive. Do I really need that test? And, of course, the reason for that is we're mostly insulated from the direct cost of the care because of insurance and Medicare. And so the laws of supply and demand don't work. I can give you another example of how it doesn't work. If you want to predict how much it costs Medicare to take care of somebody in the last 6 months of their life, the best predictor for that is the number of ICU beds per capita in the community. More beds, mm-hmm. more expense. It's not the way it's supposed to work in a capitalistic system, which is mm-hmm. the laws of supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, I guess, almost at even at the political front, that is the crux of a lot of the issues. A question it comes to my mind is why. I mean, you've hinted around that the capitalistic system increases quality and often holds costs down. If we're looking at golf clubs, cars, and so forth, so why? Let's ask a little bit harder about why is it that it doesn't work in medicine? And I guess one question that comes to my mind is one difference is we have insurance, or health insurance in particular, that's different than buying golf clubs or producing gin or cars.
Yeah, it's a complicated question,
sure,
at some level.
Sure.
But health insurance, to call our health insurance is a bit of an oxymoron. Classically, when people buy insurance, what they're doing is they're a whole bunch of people pay into a pool of money. And nobody really wants to have to take money out of it, that pool, because if it does, it means something bad happened to you. You know, with fire insurance, how many people, what percentage of people dip into the pool any given year that are paying into it for their fire insurance? Well, very few. Well, health insurance has evolved over the years to be sort of an entitlement.
Hmm.
We all pay in, or those of us that are lucky enough to have insurance, either we're paying in or our employers are paying in, or in the case of Medicare, the government's paying in. And you expect to take money out of the system. And in fact, you see it as an entitlement. So there's very little restraint on people to demand everything that can possibly be done in every circumstance.
So really, what you're saying in a sense is that health insurance is not really insurance in the same way as buying automobile insurance or life insurance.
Not even close, although
yeah.
you could draw the analogy with with automobile insurance,
okay.
in which you don't dare make a claim because then they'll cancel your policy.
Right. I've heard it said, and again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this issue because I know you've got a lot of issues that you have written down or have pretty good evidence that are costs that are driving our healthcare. But it seems like maybe you could argue that the whole healthcare spiral started about the time health insurance became a product in this country, maybe right after the war, it seems like. Is that make sense to you?
Well, if you look at when healthcare costs started rising really rapidly, mm-hmm. it was when Medicare came on board.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the early 60s.
Yeah. Okay. And was Medicare kind of a response to the private insurance issues that big companies were already expanding, or was that more of a I've heard it said, is this kind of the government's way to pay back those individuals who, had spent, sacrificed their life and then spent some time in the wars and so forth? I know that's kind of, I've heard explain why it started maybe in Europe is health insurance as a benefit.
Well, the way Paul Ginsberg in my video explains it is that it came out of World War II mm-hmm. because there was wage controls.
Okay.
So that employers the only way they could seduce employees is by giving them benefits because they couldn't increase their wages. And one of the benefits that they could give that wasn't controlled was health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And back then it was cheap because we really couldn't do much. It was before the days of technology and technological interventions. And so coming through the 50s, we had very high employment. So people getting insurance through the workplace worked very well, except there was a group of people that were not included, and that was the elderly, the retired people. And back then, because of the Depression and World War II, our elderly population was our poorest subgroup. They were the people that struggled the most, that had the hardest time paying the bills, and it turns out they didn't have health insurance. And since it wasn't very expensive, the government stepped up to the plate and said, well, we're gonna cover our senior citizens. Well, they never dreamed that it would get to be as expensive as it is. And the interesting thing is now our elderly population is our wealthiest population.
Yeah, good point. You had also, both on the video and alluded to already in the comments, that technology is a huge driver of our current healthcare costs. And at least some of the stuff I'm seeing from the Congressional Budget Office say that's probably our primary reason for big costs. And I know the Europeans are even struggling with this. You want to talk about that and how that drives things?
Well, technology is really useful in a lot of ways. But when new technologies come online, and there's also because there's a lot of profits in it, there's lots of people trying to come up with new technologies that help us do more things with greater certainty. And the technology works in tandem with the fear of liability, so that when there's a technology out there that I can invoke that is of greater benefit than risk to my patient, it doesn't matter how much it costs. I have to offer that to my patient. Because if I don't offer it to my patient and there's a bad outcome, I'm going to get sued. So that really, the video tries to get at the heart of the healthcare system, which is the relationship between the patient and the physician. And when you come and sit in front of me, I have to see you as an individual that's more important than anything else in the world. And so I make decisions for you based on a cost, on a risk-benefit analysis. And I have to offer you everything that might be of any benefit at all, regardless of cost. I don't have to apply a cost-benefit analysis to it, and I don't. I can't say to myself, you know, I can offer you this proton beam radiation treatment for your prostate cancer, and it's going to cost $70,000, and it's going to give you a, I'm making up these next numbers, I'm going to give you a 5% chance or a 15% chance or a 20% chance of living another 4 months. I offer that treatment to you. I don't ask the question, how can that $70,000 be better spent controlling diabetes, controlling hypertension, controlling obesity, and spread out among the people, all of the people, with the idea of alleviating the most suffering? I mean, we really should have a healthcare system that attempts to maximize health and minimize suffering, instead of a healthcare system that sees everybody as the most important individual in the world. Damn the costs.
Yeah,
it's a tough concept. It's
right.
Really, it seems kind of cruel.
Right, right. And even in the Western countries like Switzerland and England and Germany that Joe Neal and them were highlighting, that's still a huge issue for them, and particularly England has got a national institute that tries to make these decisions. And it's just another way, I guess, another way of looking at it is rationing care. Everybody has to ration it in some way. We do it in this country in certain ways. But technology and newer treatments are an issue in all health care systems.
Right, and the only difference is they have systems and we don't. and that... when I
right.
talk to people and I lay down this concept of we can't give everybody everything they want every time they want it, they say, well, that's rationing. We can't have rationing. And the point is we already have rationing. We ration on the basis of insurance status. We ration on the basis of whether or and so if you have a diagnosis of a serious cancer today, mm-hmm. if you don't have health insurance, your chances of dying from that cancer are twice as great as somebody who does have insurance.
Right.
So at some level, we're rationing irrationally.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had a system where we all realized we were in the same boat and we have to make rational decisions with how we're going to use our sort of precious healthcare resources, then we'll ration rationally.
In health, fear or money and fear, the film that you've made, you list some drivers of the healthcare cost technologies, which we talked about, liability, which you've mentioned, drug costs, which we should probably talk about, something called the primary care crisis, which I'd love for you to talk about, pressure for profits, we've alluded to, and insurance. And I was just looking at those, and you're right. Physicians are critical to the technology, the liability issues, drug costs, and pressure for profits. So in a sense, the physicians do have a very important role to play, and increasingly, it seems to me, the capitalistic system has pushed medicine and physicians more into a business model than they were prior to, let's say, the 50s or 60s. Is that another way of kind of saying the same thing?
Yes, I think that physicians are increasingly seen as technicians, mm-hmm. and physicians coming out of these are generalizations, and mm-hmm. I don't want to be accused of misrepresenting people or overstating
right.
the case, but I think it's unarguable that physicians that come out of training right now have a lot of debt, and they see medicine as more of a business than, say, it was seen in the 1950s and 60s and even the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the primary care crisis, and I think of all of the ills of our healthcare system, the crisis in primary care is really at the core of a lot of it. We're losing primary care doctors. They're retiring. They're going into hospitalist care. They're getting out of the business because it's so difficult. And the reason we're losing primary care doctors, aside from the fact that it's a very difficult job, is they get paid literally a fraction of what the specialists make.
Mm-hmm.
You can go in if you a dermatologist makes 50% or twice as much as a family doctor. There's just no reason for that. An orthopedic doctor can make three times as much as a family doctor. And so these physicians who are just human beings come out of training, and they look around and they've got all these debts, and they go, God, I'm smart enough to get through medical school. Why should I go into primary care? Now, the reason it's important to have primary care physicians in the system, primary care providers, and nurse practitioners would be included in that, is that every place it's ever been looked at, both in this country and internationally, the more primary care providers you have in a given area, the better the care and the cheaper the total cost. And when we say better care, we're talking about health care outcomes. We're talking about longevity. We're talking about infant mortality. Things that are measurable. And we just don't have the primary care workforce that we need. And if you look at our healthcare system and you look and you use the three major criteria for judging how good a healthcare system is, and that would be cost, quality, and access. Well, cost, we're paying twice as much per capita as just about all of the rest of the industrialized world, more than twice as much than some. So we're not doing a very good job on cost. Access, well, we have 47 million uninsured Americans. People in this country go bankrupt because of health care costs, and that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world, in the industrialized world. And you say, well, yeah, we can put up with that because we've got such good quality. But the point is we don't have good quality of care. We're right around 37th internationally in outcome, just above Cuba. that spends one-tenth per capita what we spend on health care. And the reason our quality isn't very good gets back to this lack of primary care when you look at outcomes. The care that people are getting today is increasingly fragmented because they've got lots of specialists. And the primary care physician, the sicker the patient gets, the more marginalized the primary care physician gets in overseeing the care of the patient. These guys are just overwhelmed, and so when people get sick, they get lost into the hospital, they get lost into specialty care, and eventually they come wandering into my emergency room, and they're on literally two dozen medications. Nobody's going to take them off of a medication that some other specialist put them on. And when they're very sick, it's even worse because now their primary care doctor has been so marginalized in the care of the patient that we keep invoking technology to keep these people alive long beyond reasonably we should even be trying. We get involved in a lot of futile care, and it costs a lot of extra money, and there's a lot of extra suffering. So we don't even have good quality of care, and I think it comes to the lack of primary care providers.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. My guest today is Paul Hochfeld. He's produced a film called Health, Money, and Fear. There's a link to the website on our website, plus other sources of information that really do parallel quite well what Dr. Hochfeld has done. And you can go to this website and just listen to the movie in parts completely, or you can order the DVD. And it's actually extremely well done. He's interviewed some of the leaders in the country on this. So I would strongly urge people who have some questions about where we are with our healthcare system to do that. However, if you've got questions right now, issues that are on your mind, you can reach Dr. Hochfeld and myself in Anchorage by calling 550-8433, 550-8433. Also, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us by email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Dr. Hochfeld is joining us from Oregon by telephone, but we can help answer those questions. Remember also, between 7 and 8 tonight, you're listening to a rebroadcast. So if you're listening at that time on KSKA, we would not be able to answer your questions. Paul, we've addressed a lot of the primary issues that you've brought up. We haven't discussed the issue of drug costs, and we're starting to get several phone calls come in. Let's just talk about how the cost of drugs fit into this whole idea you have. And let me remind our listeners also, at the end of the program, I'm going to give you a chance to also give us an idea how we'd handle this if you were the health czar. So we're going to talk about the problems, but we'll try to come up with some suggestions at the end as well, or you will. I'm not sure I'm the expert on this. But what about the drug costs? That's something people talk about.
We're one of two countries in the world, only two countries in the world, that allows for the mass marketing of prescription drugs. The other one is New Zealand, and I believe they're thinking about doing something about that, so that the drug companies, through mass marketing, create demand, and they create demand for conditions that are really expanded conditions of normal human function or dysfunction, and like social anxiety disorder, which sometimes I experience when I'm giving talks, and they would like me to take a drug for that to calm me down, mm-hmm. or erectile dysfunction, which I just really like saying that on the radio. but they expand the diagnosis, expand the definition of certain diagnoses, and then they market these drugs, and most of the drugs that they're marketing are what are called Me Too drugs, because they're saying Me Too, Me Too. And what they do is they take an existing drug, and classically it would be a drug for depression or a drug for ulcer disease or a drug for hypertension or a drug for diabetes. And notice these are all chronic conditions. They really like selling drugs for chronic conditions. They don't want to give you a drug that's going to cure you. They want to give you a drug that you're going to take for the rest of your life. And they come up with a drug, and this drug is a cash cow for them until the patent expires. Just about the time that their patent expires, they come up with a Me Too drug. And FDA regulations suggest, or what FDA regulations do is they say, well, you, in order to market a drug, you have to prove that it's safe and effective. But you only have to prove that it's safe and effective compared to a placebo. So they come up with new drugs that really aren't any better than old drugs, and then they market them really heavily, pretending that they're more effective than the old drugs. And then they talk customers, television viewers, into asking for these drugs from their doctor, and the doctor... It just takes too long to fight with the patient, so you just give them the drug.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead. I've got a couple of callers, and I want to see what questions they may have. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, thanks. Real interesting show. Let's see. I recently retired, and I don't have a health care savings account anymore. But one of the things that I was thinking that would help lower the cost of lifetime medical, you know, in other words, if you had a health care savings account from the time you were born, okay, however it was funded through income tax return or whatever, if you could pay immediately to the health care provider and the doctor, they in turn could lower the costs. Because one of the problems that they have is that, you know, you walk into the emergency room, you have no insurance, and here at Providence, they don't turn you away. So, and anybody with insurance ends up paying for that person. I understand the Cato Institute thought that that was a good idea as well, and I think that might be a record. That's the first time I ever agree with them on anything. So I was just wondering if there was ever any thought to Medicare could support some manner of payment. It can't support where it's set right now, but if we had five payers at 20%, the patient with his health care savings account, 20% cash out of pocket, state, federal government, and the provider, and maybe even the doctor itself, everybody lowering their prices because immediate payment was is in the offing. Has anybody ever come up with an idea like this?
You're getting at the problem of everybody's paying for everybody that isn't paying.
Yeah, that's it.
Right. And that's why I think if we all just had one giant risk pool, one giant insurance company, one single payer,
could be the
that would
government.
Solve a lot of the problems. Now, we haven't even, this is like almost a half hour into the program, and we haven't even talked about insurance companies, and I would say shame on us. Because of all of the insurance companies, depends on who you talk to, but somewhere between 25% and 33% of all our health care dollars are wasted in the friction of supporting all of these insurance companies. This is excess overhead. And, you know, I mean, whether it's 30% or 25% or 20%, in any case, it's plenty for us to use to cover the cost of everybody that's not being covered right now. And you're right, if everybody gets covered, prices should go down. I don't see prices ever going down. The healthcare reform debate right now is largely there are two camps. There are those that want to utilize free markets to correct it, and then there are those who want more centralization, more government control. And I don't really like the government any more than anybody else, but I've gotten to the point where I trust the government more than I trust the insurance companies. The problem with using free markets is that because things are expensive, and they're going to stay expensive one way or the other, you're going to have people that just aren't going to get the care that they need because they can't afford it. They can't afford to manage their diabetes. They can't afford to manage their hypertension. When these people get sick, they're going to show up in my emergency room, and we're going to do what we're legally obligated to do, and which happens to be the right thing to do. We're going to take care of them, regardless of cost. When they can't pay their bill, at the point which they lose everything, and 50% of all bankruptcies in this country are because of health care costs, then the hospital ends up eating the bill. When the hospital eats the bill, everybody pays for it anyway. So we've sort of got this, I think it's gotten beyond, healthcare has gotten beyond the point where we can invoke these free and open markets with the expectation that they're going to work. It's just not like other industries. I'm not sure I answered your question.
I've got, you know, back to this administrative cost. I'm looking at an editorial from PLOS Medicine, which quotes a Commonwealth Fund report that says, you know, the U.S. health insurance administrative costs are 30 to 70% higher as a proportion of total health spending than countries with more efficient systems such as Germany, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. If we just fix that, we'd have $50 billion per year that we could redirect to better access, for example, of healthcare services. And access in our country is not universal. We have 40 million plus, and those numbers are probably going to increase, at least in the near future, with the economy like it's going, which then begins to snowball the effects of health care costs.
The taxpayer in this country is already footing 60% of the total cost of health care. Hmm. That's taxpayer. That's government employees, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans. And it's that 60% of its public money, with the direction of the economy and the direction of healthcare costs, that percentage is only going to get greater. So you already have 60% of the money being paid for by the taxpayer. How do you create free and open markets in a situation like that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bill. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much. Good.
All right. Yep. Diane is on line six. Let's take Diane's call. What can we do for you, Diane?
Well, this is very appropriate that you should have this today. Recently, when I became a second-class citizen at age 65, I got to experience firsthand Medicare. And I cannot believe the ineptness of it and how illogical some of the regulations are, and I know you probably can't do anything about it, but I'm so totally frustrated. And then my doctor says she can accept about, 15 or 20% of her clients as Medicare and still keep the door open. And I have been hitting my head against a stone wall talking to politicians, although when they speak to me in person, they seem to agree, that when I say I want to be able to remove myself as a Medicare patient, so some of that percentage can be opened up for other people by paying the difference of what Medicare would normally pay for my doctor's visit and what my doctor really charges. But I would like to get reimbursed for that little bit. And my husband has a doctor who is going to make him sign a contract saying, you know, you got to pay me the full amount. I'll give you a little discount, but you can't send this in and get reimbursed from Medicare for the little bit that they normally would pay. And it makes no sense. And also, it's very timely that you would have this today, because I have been spending the last 2 days writing a request for reconsideration for Medicare's denial of some laboratory procedures from an independent lab, not from a Medicare-approved lab, and I would like to get reimbursed. And they've twice denied me, although the evidence is certainly there. They did not, however, in their denial, say that they weren't going to pay and reimburse me because I went to a non-Medicare-approved lab. They have never said this. And it's going to be very interesting to see what they say. But how can we get politicians to understand that in this day of financial crisis everywhere, we've got to think outside the box?
Well, I think that Medicare is not ideal, and Medicare has got some problems. And if you want to know why we pay our primary care providers a portion of what we pay our specialists, it's because Medicare has essentially established what an hour's worth of doctor's time gets paid in certain circumstances. For instance, your primary care provider in the office gets paid so many dollars per hour for talking to people. The orthopedic surgeon in the office probably gets paid twice that much. And the orthopedic surgeon in the operating room gets paid 10 times that much. Now, why is an orthopedic surgeon's time in the operating room worth so much more than in the office and so much more than the primary care provider's time? And you can say, well, he's got a sharp instrument in his hand, and that's how they justify it. And they also justify it by saying that the orthopedic doctor had to go to school longer, had needed more training. Well, if these kids are coming out of medical school now with debt of $150,000-$200,000, and that's a lot of money, and that's the reason you have to pay the specialists more. The fallacy Thad was talking about, fallacious arguments earlier. The fallacy of that thought process is that the 1 year's income difference between an orthopedic surgeon and a primary care doctor pays for the entire medical education debt. So you can't really say that they're doing it because they've got big debts, except for the fact that if you toil as a primary care provider, it takes you a lot longer to pay off the debt. But that doesn't really justify that huge difference. And Medicare just has not gotten their head around the fact that you just have to pay primary care providers more, you have to pay specialists less, in order to have the primary care providers we need to take care of people.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because primary care providers actually work to maybe avoid some of the costly results that either the orthopedic surgeons or endocrinologists, like, you know, for diabetes, you know, would have to, that Medicare then would have to pay, because people don't take care of themselves. But how do we get these politicians to change Medicare?
You're flattering me that you think I have a solution to that. I think that the problem is a political problem. I think that when we talk about health care reform, you're only talking about health care for so long, and then what you run into is it's the political problem. Because of the way we elect our representatives, and it costs a lot of money to elect, to go through elections, our representatives will not lead people, and they will only follow,
right.
And the lobbyists, the healthcare lobbyists, have fostered what I think is a myth, but is thought of as a political reality inside the Beltway. That's the Washington Beltway. That any elected official that embraces anything that looks like single payer will get defeated.
Right.
And it's political suicide. One could argue that it's not really political suicide, it's political homicide at the hands of the healthcare lobbyists.
Right. And
but
you know
that's really the problem. We have a broken political system, and I think our healthcare system just reflects that.
Do you know that actually the biggest stumbling block to maybe fixing Medicare is actually AARP? Everything that I proposed in a Compass piece in June to fix Medicare without cost, and some of the things I just related to you, they have come back with finding excuses why it would not work. And they are big, big lobbyists.
Here's how AARP works. They've got their for-profit side and they've got their not-for-profit side.
Right.
Their for-profit side sells insurance products and allows their name to be used as endorsements for insurance products, and from that they make a lot of money. In the meantime, the not-for-profit side is allowed to lobby Washington to the tune of $70 million a year in cost to make sure that there are laws passed, and I'm thinking of like Medicare Part D, laws passed that give the constituency of AARP government benefits, government subsidies, to get products that the for-profit side of AARP can offer them.
Right.
And at the same time they do this, they have this public image of divided we fail, we want health care for everybody. They want health care for everybody, but they don't want anybody to touch Medicare because they make a lot of profits on Medicare.
Thank you for saying that.
About a year ago when I interviewed Uwe Reinhardt, I suggested to him that I thought maybe there had been enough pain inflicted on Americans. There's, you know, it's the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country is healthcare costs. And that was before we suddenly stumbled into our economic problems by our loan policies and so forth, that perhaps the time had come when politics and the politicians were going to have to respond and that Americans would begin to elect representatives who were pushing for more access and quality for healthcare. He didn't quite think at that time that the time had come. What's your thoughts at this time, Paul?
I think that you're talking about why can't we get the fix that we need and why won't politicians lead us?
Or is it
do people really want a fix?
Or are we approaching the time when, you know, in my mind, increasingly more and more people are going to be affected by increasing deductibles, increasing problems with being able to pay health care costs. It's just eventually it's going to work its way up the ladder and more people with more and more money are going to have to pay more and more a part of it. And I think eventually we will end up with some single-payer health insurance. And I'm saying, one, does that make sense? And two, are we approaching that time in your mind, particularly with Obama as president now?
I'm afraid that most of the white noise coming out of Washington suggests that we're not going to get anything that resembles single payer in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I made the video, Health, Money, and Fear, is to educate voters. And I didn't in the video really we use the word single payer, or it's used. I didn't actually create a video at the outset when I started this process of, oh, I'm going to do a video about healthcare because it's driving me nuts. I didn't really know about what was going on, and I didn't start out by saying I'm going to advocate for single payer. When I made the video, the original working title was Our Ailing Healthcare, A Physician Explores the Illness.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I used that title is it truly was an exploration. I went to the library, Corvallis Public Library, and I took out a big pile of books, and I started reading books. And as I came across the names of people that seemed to have a handle on what was going on, I tracked down their email addresses, and I told them who I was and what I was trying to accomplish, and would they give me an interview that I can videotape. And just an amazing number of really stellar people said, sure. And so I didn't know what the problem was. All I knew is that it was driving me nuts. And in the exploration, I came around to believing that the only way we're going to control costs, and I do believe it's all about cost, I think access is really a symptom of the problem, is with something that resembles single payer. And so the trouble with using those words is most people either don't know what it means, or they've got some misconception of what it means, or they say, oh, we can't have that, that's socialism.
Mm-hmm.
What single payer means is publicly financed, privately delivered health care. And this is the way it works. You take all of the money that's currently being spent by the government, and that's 60% of it, remember, and you add to that some portion or all of the insurance premiums that are being paid by employers and employees and individuals, and it's a lot of money, and you pool all that money. Now, it's not new taxes. It's not new money. This is money we're already spending on health care. And instead of calling it insurance premiums, you can call it taxes, or you can call it health fees. You can call it whatever you want to call it. But the point is, it's money we're already spending. It's not new money. And with this money, you create one giant risk pool. And that means, and everybody's covered, and hospital costs go down, and physicians' costs go down, and you don't have insurance companies spending a lot of money figuring out who they don't want to cover because they're high risk, and you create a system. And everybody is offered with this giant risk pool, this giant sum of money, a basic package of health care services. And it's the same package for everybody. This is your basic package of health care that's paid for by the public payer.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, it gets back to, can everybody have everything they want every time they want it? No. Inherent in this is going to be some form of rationing, which is actually the only way it can work. And you, like the Oregon Health Plan did, you decide what's high priority to treat and what's low priority to treat. Well, everybody gets an appendectomy if you need it, and everybody even gets an angiogram if you need it. Everybody gets immunizations and well baby checks and prenatal visits. They're at the very top of the list. And at the bottom of the list, you have proton beam radiation treatments for old men with prostate cancer. And if in any given year, the system can only afford a basic package that's this extensive, that can do so much. And if you want something that isn't cost-effective, that we can't afford, then you can still have it, but we're not going to use public money to pay for it. And that way we ration health care rationally instead of rationing irrationally. And with this big chunk of money, there is so much savings. Remember, we talked about 15, 20, 25, 30% savings. We don't really know how much it is. It depends on who you talk to. But with that savings
in
that we have,
in the administrative costs.
In the administrative costs,
right.
That's the money you use to cover the people that are now not being covered. But, in fact, they are being covered. They'd come to our emergency room, and we're all paying for them anyway.
Right.
And the point is, as long as the taxpayer pays for everybody anyway, let's have the taxpayer devise a system that pays for this. And with this system, now we have somebody in charge. And with somebody in charge, and without the paranoia of insurance companies, we can have a national electronic medical record. Maybe we can do something about liability reform. Maybe we can do something about mass marketing of prescription drugs. Maybe we can give everybody a medical home. Maybe we can start actually beefing up primary care and understanding that that's where the money, that's where the savings are, that we can't have a healthcare system in which we're only 30% primary care doctors. In some parts of the world, it's 70% primary care doctors. It's estimated you need at least 50% primary care doctors to have a cost-effective system. So that's what a single payer is. It's not socialized medicine. It's publicly financed, privately delivered.
Is that, when I think of the NPR series on Western European systems, the only one that's truly socialized was the British. And the other countries all required, it was mandated that everyone have health insurance. And then for many people, it was still insurance through employers, like in Switzerland and so forth. So what you're saying is not a lot different than that, but how would you discuss the differences between, say, as you understand, German and Switzerland and the Netherlands and how they're doing things and what you're saying?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, and I'd really hate to just sort of put my neck out, but but most of the systems are somewhat hybrid, and our health insurance companies aren't going to go away because there's probably still going to be some room for people to get covered for the services beyond the basic package, and people that want more will get more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know that Taiwan decided they were going to start a health system from scratch, and they said, you know what, why don't we just like look all around the world and see what health systems are like in other parts of the world, and let's take the best from that and the best from that and the best from that and try to match it to our particular needs. Well, they ended up with a healthcare system that looks a lot more like what the French have than what we have.
Right. Yeah, and actually when you look at those indices that you talked about like access and quality and outcomes and so forth, the French are right up there at the top. The Netherlands has a very new system that apparently is also did the same kind of thing, came up with a little bit different issue. So there's lots of people out there lots of countries doing some things that appear to be working in the early aspect of things. And the problem we're having here is we're spending twice as much as everybody else. I want to keep getting back to the basic fact. Our quality is slipping and going away, and our access is abysmal. We really need to be thinking about whether this makes sense and do we need to do something different.
Now, so the Canadians, you know, there's all these stories, anecdotes about Canadians flocking across the borders to come to our system because it's so much better. And, in fact, we have all sorts of stories here of nightmares, people going to other countries for their care as well. But the point is that the complaint about the Canadian system is there are waits for things, and some things you just don't quite get them quite as fast. The Canadians, if they spent 50% more, could probably deal with a lot of those problems. They'd still be spending 25% less than we're spending. Mm-hmm. That's just sort of putting this in some perspective.
All right. Yeah, the Canadian, I actually interviewed the president of the Canadian Medical Society, and that's the big issue up there is access, as it is in England to some degree. I did get an email, and apparently the municipality of Anchorage and some other partners are hosting a Medicare forum at the Lusac Library Assembly Chambers from 10 to 2 on January 9th. Those of you who may be interested, this is a phone number where you can get more information, 343-4698, 343-4698 if you're interested in going to a Medicare forum in the Lusac Library, 10 to 2 January 9th. Also want to take another caller. Russell, you're on the air. What can we do for you?
Hi, Thad and Paul. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, I've got a question about I was fortunate enough to have a kidney transplant about 8 months ago, and things are moving along nicely in that area. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have some good insurance through Premera Blue Cross. But just looking out into the future, you know, I'm just 50 right now, but, you know, where does this go down the road when I have to go back through the system again? And then as a follow-up, what do mere mortals do to try to support moving the system in the right direction that Paul had talked about earlier?
Okay.
Well, I think it's a political problem, and I think that the issue is how do we get our politicians to understand that we want a fix that's really substantive. We're going to always have problems with not getting everything we want every time we want it. And the question is, are we going to have a healthcare system that maximizes health and minimizes suffering, or maximizes profits? Those are the choices we have. And that our politicians don't think we want anything that resembles single payer. And I think that when people understand the issues, and they understand the direction, and they understand the crisis that our primary care base is in right now, I think people are willing to embrace something that resembles single payer. But we have to convince our politicians, because they're convinced we don't.
Have you been able to talk to people, and is there some point where they see the light go on? They go, oh, we do need to do something different.
No, you know, the problem is that the discussion usually stays within the choir. That's why I'm on the radio, and that's why I made the video. And it's very, very difficult to take the discussion past those that already agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Thanks for calling. We've got about 5 minutes. I've got one more caller I want to take. Julie, you're on line one.
Hi. I'm starting to listen to the program, so I'll have to listen to it tonight to hear the rest. But I wondered if it's not clear to me whether or not your guest has written a book or he has a video.
Yeah.
If he has a book, I'd like to know the title.
It's a video, and you can go to our website, or you can go to our ailing healthcare, I think it is, .com.
Okay. And I was wondering if you had studied Australia at all. And before you get to that, I just wanted to make a comment about how I, too, wish we had single payer. I've lived in more enlightened countries like Australia, and I wish we did. But I increasingly feel discouraged about ever getting it here, because in a country where two-thirds of high school graduates think that the sun revolves around the earth, or that they can't name what century the Civil War was fought in, I'm sort of despairing about whether or not they're ever going to grasp the issue, especially since the interests that benefit from the current system have all the money in the world. to contribute to campaigning politicians.
Well, another area, unfortunately, we seem to be slipping when you really look at it is education, particularly science and technology
right.
education. But that's another issue.
I believe there are some governors that don't believe in evolution, aren't there?
Yes, I've heard
yes,
so.
Yes, there are quite a few. And just one observation about the difference in culture, though, between here and, say, Australia.
Right.
It does seem right. that here there's historically just been more of an attitude of the romantic view of the rugged individual, and this right. which degenerates into the sense of I got mine right. and good luck to you, buddy. Whereas right. in Australia, right. there really is a national ethos of we're in this together, mate.
Yeah, and that's true through the European countries in the National Public Radio podcast. Julie, we're going to have to take a leave.
Bye.
But go to our website. There's several links to more information. Paul,
yeah, there's actually a discussion in the video about does our healthcare system reflect who we are?
Right. And what do you think of it? The answer is to that? We've got a couple of minutes. That's another issue in my mind is what is it telling us about our society to be what we're doing with healthcare?
I think it may reflect who we are, but I don't think it reflects who we want to be.
Right. Okay. Right. It's and one of the bits of information I was reading before I came on, it just does sometimes it's okay to do things for financial gain, but sometimes you just got to do the right things that there need to be done. And this is, in my mind, really becoming one of those issues where we have to be much more equitable in our access to health care. Final comments. We've got about a minute or so. What do you want us to get out of this, Paul?
I want people to be motivated. I want people to understand that quality, cost, and access, we're performing very poorly in our healthcare system. It's not working for anybody except the people that are making a lot of money off of it, and that's not the average person. And the reason it's not working has to do with the laws of supply and demand don't work in healthcare like they work in other industries. They just don't. And that we really need a system. We don't have a healthcare system. And if we had a system, then we could maybe get a handle on some of these systemic problems.
So
it's not going to fix everything. Every country in the world is struggling with healthcare costs.
Right.
We just happen to be struggling at it at twice the rate.
Yeah, and we really, in a sense, don't have a system.
No,
we got a hodgepodge of ways we're addressing this, and you're really not. I think the other thing I hear people maybe argue about is that you're promoting, or this kind of thought is promoting socialism versus being opposed to capitalism, and that's really, really not the issue here at all.
That's not the issue at all. I didn't have a chance to say if I were czar of the healthcare system, we'd have free medical education, free nurse practitioner education. It would be in trade for 3 to 4 years of public service. And we would tell medical students before they became medical students that if they wanted to make more than some arbitrarily large amount of money, like $350,000 a year, they should do something else.
Paul, good luck. Keep it up. It really is a very well done video. I encourage people to go to ourailinghealthcare.com. You can listen to the video and look at our website for more. More contacts and more links. Thanks very much for your time and good luck again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All righty. Next week we'll be back and we're going to move on to sleep disorders. If this doesn't give you enough to stay up at night, we'll see if we can help you. So today's guest, Paul Hockfield, thanks very much. Next week we'll be talking with Ron Cates about sleep disorders. So tune into your health next Monday, December 15th at 2 p.m. For Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line One, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at lineone@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.